All right, so we're back to XVI, and where we're talking about Roland Hazard and Solution and Oxford Groups and EBI. So we're going to talk about the next paragraph down, which says, prior to his journey to Akron, the broker had worked hard with many alcoholics on the theory that only an alcoholic could help an alcoholic. Everybody with me? Did I move too quick for you? But he succeeded only in keeping sober. Sometimes I just wander off by myself, so you'll have to remind me because I will lose you. The broker had gone to Akron on a business venture which had collapsed, leaving him greatly in fear he might start drinking again. He suddenly realized in order to save himself, see, he's going to go to his experience. He must carry his message to another alcoholic. The alcoholic turned out to be an Akron physician. Before I start there, oftentimes with alcoholics, if they get in what I call the four walls, and I don't care where the four walls are, oftentimes alcoholics can stay sober. They can stay sober in treatment. They can stay sober in those four walls. They can go to this, we did a lot of work, Mike and I, at the Salvation Army. They can stay sober in those four walls, but as soon as they walk out that door, they can't stay sober. And so my experience tells me, particularly when you've got one of those street-walking, gutter-hugging alcoholics who've been living outside for 10 years, I want them in the four walls. And if they call me and they drink, I say, go back to your experience of the four walls. Go back in, and you'll probably be able to stop drinking. Because that's what happened to him before. Sometimes they won't go back. So prior to the journey to Akron, the broker had worked hard with many alcoholics on the theory of, I did that, but he succeeded only in keeping sober himself. So how did we find out how to stay sober? We're trying to give it away or keep us sober. Make sense? Okay. The broker had gone to Akron on a business venture which had collapsed, leaving him greatly in fear he might start drinking again. He suddenly realized that in order to save himself, he must carry his message to another alcoholic. The alcoholic turned out to be the Akron physician. I repeat myself sometimes. Dr. Bob was raised, his dad was a probate judge, in a town that's about 100 miles from where Bill was raised. He was the only child. He had a cousin who lived with them, a girl for some reason. The folks helped her through school. She became a professor. And he was a very brilliant guy. This guy spoke five languages. He was a champion bridge player. He could pitch horseshoes like nobody. He was a great hunter, lived off of the things. It was big when he was young to go out and take nothing and kill what you eat. He said sometimes he went hungry for several days. But he's a very bright guy. And Bill thought he was far more smarter than he was. Probably true. His son said he read books that he couldn't even pronounce the names of. And so he was quite a man. He said the position had repeated. Now, he thought they were very religious people, his mother and father, and they went to church like three and four times a week. And they carried him till he's about 16. And then he threw a fit like a lot of people do when he's 16. I don't want to go anymore. And they said, fine, don't do that. His dad taught Sunday school for 42 years. His dad was very supportive. He could never say his dad didn't support him. His dad would always support him, no matter what happened to him. He'd come get him. He'd send doctors to get him. He'd heal up at home. He'd go back to school. Just all kinds of things. Dr. Bob thought the problem was sin. Now, sin means from the Greek to miss the mark. It's an archery term. So a lot of people think that when the preacher's talking about, I used to think when he's talking about sinner, I knew he was talking about me, but I didn't know it meant to miss the mark. And what I didn't know was that all human beings miss the mark. There aren't any perfect people. That might help you a little bit. I used to think there were perfect people, and I wasn't one of them. If I'm thinking it, I might as well do it. You know, he's talking about it. I've either done it or thinking about it, you know. He thought he was weak-willed. Untrue about us. We, to be an alcoholic, to survive this disease, requires great willpower. We have more will. I don't know of many people who would get up and throw up in the morning and start drinking, you know. Normal people don't have that kind of will, you know. They just one time through, and that's it for them, boy, if you ever even get them that far, you know. They get tipsy and out of control, you know, and don't you like that, you know. No, I love it. Let's get some more, you know. So, He thought he had no moral character and that he was a weakling. Anybody here ever think that? We're the most self-diagnosed people in the world. I love us. You know, not a doctor in sight, but boy, we just go to think, well, this must be what's wrong, and this must be what's wrong, and this has got, I'm weak-willed. That's my problem. No. So this physician had repeatedly tried spiritual means to resolve his alcoholic dilemma, but it failed. But when the broker gave him Dr. Silkworth's description, step one, of alcoholism and its hopelessness, physical allergy and mental obsession, the physician began to pursue the spiritual remedy for his malady with a willingness he never before been able to muster, step two. He sobered never to drink again up to the moment of his death in 1950. This seemed to prove that one alcoholic could affect another as no non-alcoholic could. Now, he is called the Prince of the 12-Steppers. His wife will die in 1949, and he will die in 1950. I have a recording of them at home. She just had an eye taken out. Her eyes went bad, and the surgeon tried to do some work, and she lost the eye through an infection, and she used a magnifying glass the rest of her life. She was a wonderful woman, and Bill called her the mother of Alcoholics Anonymous. Sister Ignatia used her as a social worker. When the guys were in, she would call her up and say, check on the family. She'd check on the family if they were hungry, if they needed fixing, if the plumbing was bad, if the houses had the windows kicked out, they'd put them in. The men would come out and fix all that while the guy was in the hospital. I'll tell you more about how they did that. It required people putting up money for another guy. So this seemed to prove that one alcoholic could affect another as no non-alcoholic, I believe that's true, could. It indicated that strenuous work, one alcoholic with another, was vital to permanent recovery. And in there, many years ago, I wrote, life-sustaining to who? To me. Life-sustaining to me. Hence, the two men set to work almost frantically upon the alcoholics arriving in the ward of the Akron City Hospital. Their very first case, a desperate one, recovered immediately and became AA number 3. His name was Bill Dotson. Now, they did work with other people. There was a man named Eddie Riley that lived with them. And Eddie was a nut who was a little skinny guy, and they kept him upstairs, locked up sometimes, while they got the next step. And he would skinny down the rain pipe, and he would run, and Dr. Bob would get in his car because he was older, and Bill would run on foot, and they would chase him down and bring him back. Then they really bit off a bunch. They got his little blonde wife and two kids to come live with him, and he used to beat her up. And then he chased Ann with a butcher knife one time. Bill had to take that away from him. So they decided, as he got sobered up, that he had some other problems other than alcoholism. So they took a group conscience and sent him to the insane asylum. So, but the miracle of it was that in Dr. Bob's funeral in 1950, young Smith was standing there burying his dad. And a lot of people, naturally, he was very popular. And a guy walked up and tapped him on the shoulders, and he turned around and he said, "Do you remember me?" This may make me cry. He said, "Well, yeah, you're Eddie Riley." And he said, "I belong to a certain group. I've been sober for 1 year. I mean, I don't know what you call that, you know." Great stuff. The message you carry may not take today, but it may take later on. And that's very important. Your ego don't get caught up in, "Oh, I got to save him right now." That's almost an impossibility. So he says, hence the two men set to work almost frantically. I did that. AA number 3 became Bill Dotson. There was another guy named Doc M. It didn't take on him. And he said he would never have another drink. Great guy. Lawyer. This work in Akron, it's very hard for lawyers to get sober and stay that way. Their work requires lying, I think. No, that's not, I'm sorry, it's just a joke. I do have a vicious mind from time to time. Where'd you go? You're supposed to be up here in a minute. Quit that smoke and get in the house. There are many failures, but there's an occasional heartening success. When the broker returned to New York in the fall of 1935, the first AA group had actually been formed, though no one had realized it at the time. A second small group promptly took shape at New York, to be followed in 1937 with the start of a third at Cleveland. There are people that debate that. Besides these, there are scattered alcoholics who have picked up the basic ideas in Akron and New York and were trying to form groups in other cities. That's exactly how it was done. Boy, I'm glad you're here. We're going to take a cigarette break in a minute. By late November 1937, he says the number of members having substantial sobriety time behind them was sufficient to convince the membership that a new light had entered the dark world of alcoholism, and that's what I told you about the 18 people and the 40 they could count sober. It was now time the struggling groups thought to place their message, the history, the experience, and unique experience before the world. This determination bore fruit in the spring of April, actually, of 1939, by the publication of this volume. The membership had then reached about 100 men and women. The fledgling society, which had been nameless, now began to be called Alcoholics Anonymous from the title of its own book. The flying blind period ended, and AA entered a new phase of pioneering times. With the appearance of the new book, a great deal began to happen. Dr. Harry Emerson Fosdick, the noted clergyman, reviewed it with approval. In the fall of 1939, Fulton Auster, then editor of Liberty, printed a piece in his magazine and called Alcoholics and God. This brought a rush of 800 frantic inquirers into the little New York office, which meanwhile had been established. Think about it. There's two people there. There's Ruth Hawks, and there's Bill Wilson. And they just got 800 letters. They do not have a computer. They have an Underwood typewriter. And so they got a little help, not much. Would you sit down, and I guess it's a question for you, would you sit down and divide 800 letters up among this group and handwrite the answers? And stay in contact with those people? Would you do that? They did. That's how important they thought it was. A little question to ask yourself. Into the little New York office, which meanwhile had been established. I'd have sponsorees do it. That's each inquiry was painstakingly answered. Pamphlets and books were sent out. Businessmen and traveling out of the existing groups were referred to these prospective newcomers. New groups were started up, and it was found to the astonishment of everyone that AA's message could be transmitted in the mail as well as by word of mouth. They didn't know that at the time. They didn't know the book was going to work because they'd always done it face to face. They had no idea that this was going to work, and now we do it modem to modem. I don't even know how to use a computer. Anyway, by the end of 1939, it was estimated 800 alcoholics were well on their way to recovery. In the spring of 1940, John D. Rockefeller Jr. gave a dinner for many of his friends to which he invited AA members to tell their stories. News of this got on the world wires. Inquirers poured in again, and many people went to the bookstores to get the book Alcoholics Anonymous. By March 1941, the membership had shot up over 2,000. Jack Alexander wrote a feature article in the Saturday Evening Post to place such a compelling picture of AA before the general public that Alcoholics Anonymous and need of help really deluged us. By the close of 1941, AA's numbered 8,000 members. The mushrooming process was in full swing, and AA had become a national institution. That's not bad for a bunch of unwanted people. I have a book study at the house, and it's outgrown the house, and it's been outgrown for a long time. People sit out and listen through the windows. I happen to have a big room, about half as big as this. And the people, I finally said to them, I think God wants us to move. They said, thank God you caught on. We've been needing to move for a long time. We got a lot of people who'd come to this thing. We just had no room, you know. I don't know anything. So our society entered a fearsome and exciting adolescent period. It test of face was it could such a large number of erstwhile erratic alcoholics successfully meet and work together. Now we're going to talk about traditions. If you want to study these traditions, there's all kinds of information out there. I've probably got 15 people doing traditions. I brought up a set of stuff by Cora Louise Belford. I think Cora came in 1957, worked for Bill Wilson for a number of years at the Central Office in New York, gives a great talk on traditions. Simple and easy, not too complicated. Said, would there be quarrels over membership and leadership and money? Well, most of you have been here a little while. You've seen that, I guess, haven't you? Every bit of this. Would there be striving for power and prestige? Would there be schisms which would split AA apart? Soon AA was beset with these very problems on every side and in every group. But out of this frightening and at first disrupting experience, the conviction grew that AA had to hang together or die separately. We had to unify our fellowship and pass off the scene As we discovered the principle of which the individual alcoholics could live, so we had to evolve principles of which AA groups and AA as a whole could survive and function effectively. So what you do is you take that one sentence and you'll find that to be tradition one. And that's the way I tell you, give you a little study, is you take each one of these sentences and you line it up, because he gives it to you in one sentence, one thought. And you line it up with the long form of the traditions and you'll be in business. You'll have a basic understanding of what he's trying to get to. It was thought that no alcoholic man or woman would be excluded from our society, that our leaders might serve but never govern, but that our groups were to be autonomous, self-governed by God, and there'd be no professional class of therapy. There's to be no fees or dues. Our expenses were to be met by our own voluntary contributions. There was to be the least possible organization. Remember that. The least possible. We're not an autonomy. We're not an autonomy. Some people would like us to be. So, he said, it'd be the least possible organization, even our service centers. Our public relations was to be based upon attraction rather than promotion. It was decided all members ought to be anonymous at the level of press, radio, TV, and film. And in those circumstances should be we give endorsements, make alliances, or enter into public controversy. Bill Wilson was asked from 1950 was all about the traditions. That's what the 1950 convention was about. 1955, it was decided that Bill would give 5 talks at every convention, and he did so, except that then he dies in 70. So 71, I think it is, so he didn't speak at that convention other than to tell you goodbye. But in these talks, he talks about all these things. He talks about his anonymity and all the things that they wanted him to do and he wouldn't do, that kind of stuff. So it goes on to say, in those circumstances, should we give endorsement, make alliances, or enter into public controversy? And I would ask you to think about these traditions in a way that protects the what? What do you think it protects? What is the group? Well, that's part of it. If you don't have a solution, you haven't got nothing. The group is the keeper of the solution. That makes sense? Okay, go a little further. Just something for you to think about. This was the seventh of AA 12 traditions that are stated fully in page 564 of this book. Though none of these principles have the force of what? Rule or law. Don't have any. There's no enforcement here. So I hear people all the time working on enforcement. Except by 1950, they were confirmed by the first international conference at Cleveland by the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. Okay. Today, the remarkable unity of AA is one of the greatest assets that our society has. While the internal difficulties of adolescent period was being ironed out, public acceptance of AA grew by leaps and bounds. For this, there were two principal reasons. The large number of recoveries and reunited homes. We had to show somebody something. We just couldn't talk about it. And God, look at us today. Look at us today. He says, for this, there were two principal reasons, a large number of recoveries and reunited homes. They made their impression everywhere. If alcoholics who came to AA and really tried, 50% got sober at once and remained that way. 25% sobered up after some relapses. They're talking about people that applied the steps, applied the solution. They're not talking about people that just dropped in and sat around for a while. Really tried. And it said, sobered up after some relapse, and among the remainder, those who stayed on with AA showed improvement. I never could figure that out. Maybe they were periodic, so I never have been, you know, maybe they could, by the influence of that. I know people that slowed their drinking down, you know, but I'm a real alcoholic. You give me alcohol, I don't stop. Those who stayed on with AA showed improvement. Other thousands came to a few AA meetings and at first decided they didn't want the program, but great numbers of these, about 2 out of 3, began to return as time passed. So I want to go back to tradition for just a second. What is AA? You got to figure out what AA is. And Bill Wilson on page 15 of the 12 of 12 talks about what AA is. He says AA is a set of principles, spiritual in their nature, when it practices a way of life, and if sell the obsession to drink and make you happy, useful, and whole. That's what AA is. But once you get that as the measurement stick, Then you decide from there where you want to go when people are breaking traditions, not breaking traditions. You know, this sometimes is we get in big discussions about some of this stuff. Another reason for the wide acceptance of AA was the ministration of friends, friends in medicine, religion, and the press, together with innumerable others who became our able and persistent advocates. Without such support, AA could have made only the slowest progress. Some of the recommendations of AA's earliest medical and religious friends will be found further on in this book. We weren't so proud in those days. We took help from anybody. There was a lady who's called the Angel of Detroit, who was the first secretary, and she was a non-alcoholic. She was a social worker who helped that all get started there. Interesting. Alcoholics Anonymous is not a religious organization. Neither does AA take any particular medical point of view, though we cooperate widely with the men of medicine as well as with the men of religion. Alcohol would be in no respecter of persons. We are an accurate cross-section of American and distant lands. The same democratic evening up process is now going on. By personal religion affiliation, we include Catholics, Protestants, Jews, Hindus, and a sprinkling of Muslims and Buddhists. More than 15% of us are women. There are a number of things that come out every five, there's a survey that comes out every so often that you can pick it up and it tells you the figures. At present, our membership is pyramiding at the rate of about 20% a year. So far, upon the total problem of several million actual and potential alcoholics in the world, we have made only a scratch. In all probabilities, we should never be able to touch more than a fair fraction of the alcoholic problem in all of its ramifications. Upon therapy for the alcoholic himself, we surely have no monopoly. Absolutely not. Please go do whatever you got to go do. And fact is, I'd like it. If I had had one more good idea, I'd have been dead. I'm telling you. I mean, I run out of ideas, man. And they got to run out. You got to let them run out of ideas. I mean, you can't stand and block their bottom. You got to let them run out of ideas. That's a good idea. Go try that one, you know. Upon therapy for the alcoholic himself, we surely have no monopoly. Yet it is our great hope that all of those who have yet found no answer may begin to find one in the pages of this book and will presently join us on a high road to new freedom. Now.
I'm Mike McKissick. I'm an alcoholic. I got to tell you, I had too much coffee already today, and so I'm a little jumpy up here. It's always great when you do share the podium with your sponsor. So, sometimes you wonder if you're going to, like, you know, anything I say comes from my experience, but then I got my alter ego sitting next to you over here. So, having said that as a little pre-qualification, we're going to talk a little bit about a forward to the third edition and the forward to the fourth edition. I'm going to sit down because I'm going to read some of this. So with the third edition, it said by March 1976, when this edition went to print, the total worldwide membership of Alcoholics Anonymous Conservative was estimated at 1 million, 28,000 groups. So surveys of the groups, United States and Canada, indicate AA is reaching out not only to more and more people, but to a wider and wider range. Women now make up more than one-fourth of the membership. So at that point, it was one-fourth. In Toronto, at the International this last year, that's where they presented the survey that shows the mix of the membership as they take the survey and everything else. And now the women make up, at that time, they were talking almost one-third of the membership of Alcoholics Anonymous. So the next paragraph says, the basic principles of the AA program, it appears, hold good for individuals with many different lifestyles, just as the program has brought recovery to those of many different nationalities. The universality of the program is being shown more and more all the time. The 12 steps that summarize the program may be called, and here goes my Spanish and French that won't work, Los Doce Apostles in one country and Los Doce Estapas in another, but they trace exactly the same path to recovery that was blazed by the earliest members of Alcoholics Anonymous. I think what this says and what this tells us is that the 12 steps are the program of recovery, and they trace it exactly the same path. You know, I get lost sometimes in the fellowship where you run into sponsees and you run into other people that'll tell you that I'm going to get sober some other way other than with the book. My experience is that the program of recovery is in the book. What I think the book says to me is that the program of recovery is in the book. And it It's substantiated here because they trace exactly the path. So it's like any path. No, it talks about this is the textbook. It is specific. It is exactly. These are the steps that we took. So in spite of the great increase in the size and the span of the fellowship, at its core it remains simple and personal. Each day somewhere in the world, recovery begins when one alcoholic talks to another alcoholic, sharing experience, strength, and hope. And that was the case in Bill and Bob. And one of the things, I'll go back a little bit to the brief history of in the forward to the second edition, when they were talking about, you know, Bob had not had this spiritual experience. Well, he'd been 2.5 years in the Oxford group. And it wasn't just the spiritual experience or having a spiritual life that led Bob to recovery. It was at that moment when Bill and Bob got together. You know, the thing that sets us apart from anything else is one alcoholic talking to another alcoholic. Fourth edition, then. The fourth edition came off the press in November 2001, the start of the new millennium. Since the third edition was published in 1976, worldwide membership of AA has about doubled to an estimated 2 million or more, with nearly 100,800 groups meeting in approximately 150 countries around the world. The literature has played a major role in AA growth, and a striking phenomenon of the past quarter century has been the explosion of translations of our basic literature into many languages and dialects. In country after country where AA's seed was planted, it's taken root slowly at first, then growing by leaps and bounds when literature has become available. Currently, Alcoholics Anonymous has been translated into 43 languages. As the message of recovery has reached larger numbers of people, it has also touched the lives of a vastly greater variety of suffering alcoholics. When the phrase, "We are people who normally do not mix," page 17 of this book, was written in 1939, it referred to a fellowship composed largely of men and a few women, with quite similar social, ethnic, and economic backgrounds. Like so much of AA's basic text, these words have proved to be far more visionary than the founding members could have imagined. The stories added to this edition represent a membership whose characteristics of age, gender, race, and culture have widened and deepened to encompass virtually everyone the first 100 members could have hoped to reach. It says here, while our literature has preserved the integrity of the AA message, sweeping changes in society as a whole are reflected in the new customs and practices within the fellowship. So the preservation of the message is in the book. The book hasn't changed. And I think you want to add anything before we go on to the doctor's opinion?
I've had a little cookie now with chocolate in it. Boy, watch me roll now. And a Diet Coke. I'll try to slow down a little bit. The reason I'm pressing on here, I wanted to get through this to get into more of the meat of the program here. I just wanted to get a little feeling for history. Sometimes I don't finish what I'm talking about. I don't know what's wrong with my mind, but at one time in this country, they used to, because with the doctor's opinion, they used to put us in, I don't remember if I finished all this story or not, but they used to put us in mental hospitals, and then we'd sober up. About 72 hours is what it takes to get alcohol out of us. And other than being sick, well, it don't take long for us to come back, usually speaking, unless we're wet brained. They used to think even that was long lasting. Today, the brain, amazing thing the brains do sometimes. I got a doctor friend by the name of Dr. Mark. He's 23 years sober. He believes AA is the only way in the world to get sober. And he works in emergency rooms. He's 35 years a doctor. He gives great talks on the, he and I go around giving him some talks on the doctor's opinion from a doctor's point of view. And, he said this guy was right on the money. This is a story he told me one time. He said, you know, he's a little guy. And he said, I used to be the toughest guy in Brooklyn when I was drinking. And he said, after a while, I had to figure out, the mind has four different areas it talks, and when senses come in, that's how things come to you. The mind examines it through these different relays, talks to these different systems, and the systems tell them whether to run or fight. You know, is it dangerous, is it not, this kind of thing. Well, what if you drink and you drug, those systems shut down. They don't completely shut down, but they act like this. Did you see that? they lose their ability to communicate with each other in milliseconds. You know, they're just all, you know. So all of a sudden, I think I'm the toughest guy in the world. I don't know the mind is. That's why. But anyway, you're going to understand that. You'll be smarter than most guys. They wrote a book about him. All the people that we would call Dr. Bob, a lot's been written about him. If you go to look for Dr. Bob to speak on tape, you won't find very much of it. Bill was far more the speaker and lived a lot longer and got around a lot more. Dr. Bob worked with 5,000 people. He never charged for that service. So he was quite a guy. Bill said he was probably a better guy, at least from a religious, knowing something about religion or any of that, than he ever was. Gave him a lot of credit that way. This doctor goes to school and graduates from Princeton in 1896. He comes from a working man's family, and his brother and his dad worked to put him through school. He showed he had the talent for it, and they were willing to put that boy through school. That's quite an effort when you start. It's one thing about the dad, but the brother to give up a good part of his life. He marries, he will have one child, the child dies, it was little, and that was the end of having children. Every time he turned around, he gets started. He's a neuropsychiatrist, and also an MD, because in those days they treated everything. They didn't specialize like they do today. They did have psychiatry, but you also had to be able to treat the patient. We'll look at some of that as he goes. He goes to work, he gets his MD at New York University, and he does his internship in 1900 at Bellevue, a very famous hospital in New York. They have a very famous nut ward there. he will work, he went to work at Towns Hospital. He made $40 a week in room and board. His practice, his private practice, had been destroyed by the Depression, just like a lot of other people. Every time he gets started, something would happen and take him out of this private practice thing. He's born in 1873, and he dies in 1951. I don't know if anybody cares about that but me, but just the kind of things I seem to catch on to. He was in the Army for 2 years. He was in World War I. He was a psychiatrist, a staff psychiatrist at Plattsburgh, where Bill had gone through. And so he served in military service. So he goes to work for Towns Hospital. Towns Hospital was owned by a guy named Charlie Towns. And Charlie came out of Kentucky, I think. Maybe was a mule skinner, I don't know. Anyway, it was a very expensive hospital. And made lots of money. And so Bill will be there more than once. There are some people that say that it was close to him that he detoxed 40 times. Now, I don't know if that was all in that hospital. Jail. He went to jail some, too. When Bill drank, he became Jekyll and Hyde. He liked to fight. So anyway, this little doctor comes to this hospital. He goes to work there in 1930. There are 16 printings of the book before he let his name go into the book. I want to just suggest to you, as Mike goes through this with you, that this doctor put his professional qualifications on the line for us. I have never known. I worked in hospitals in 1954 to 57. I was a medic in the service. I've never known where they let a guy come in and say, you know, I had a spiritual experience and my heart was healed. I've never known the doctors to let you on the wardens to tell you about that. It's something they just don't do. You don't let non-professionals on wards treat people where science is involved. And this is not scientific. But he's as you go through the story, he takes a beating. He did about 30,000 people before Bill ever came on the scene. He worked with another 6,000 people, 45,000 people all at Towns, and he worked with another 6,000 people at a place called Knickerbocker's, which is a famous hospital but was much cheaper. And so you could go through Knickerbocker's for about $75 in those days. This one was very expensive. And so as you go through this thing, he did not come into this work. It was never his intention to work with alcoholics. And so in this work, he had to heal the ruptured, the stomach, the whatever was going on, the bad kidneys. He had to do a lot of healing of the body before he'd go to work on the mind. And so he had to do it all. And he will tell you, I can tell you his rate of recovery was 1 to 2%. Medical science has not done that much better yet. And they stretch it a little bit. 4%, some people say 3. I don't know who counts that stuff. But this guy talks about 1 to 2%. I looked for years to find out what moral psychology was. I mean, I'm telling you, I'm giving you something. I studied for, I never could figure it out. I could never find it out from anybody. What moral, I got all kinds of people giving me all kinds of answers. And the book that came out, they wrote about his life, told me. He also is written about in the Grapevine in 1945. I also found it there. So he says, moral psychology, a new interpretation of old ideas. How do you like that? What does that tell you? It tells you if the mind stays the same, that's what we're going to work on. Can't do anything about the allergy. But if the mind stays the same, you are doomed to drink again. Something's got to change up there. And that's what he called moral psychology. A new interpretation of old ideas. And I thought that was a wonderful find. Mike, you ready?
So we get to the doctor's opinion. Now, I've heard, but I've never seen a copy of a first edition of the Big Book. But when they say the Big Book never changed, I understand, at least what I've heard, is that originally the doctor's opinion was page 1 of the Big Book. Because sometimes you have people talk, you say, the solution's in the first 164 pages of the Big Book. Well, it's the first 164 pages and the doctor's opinion. And if maybe I'll verify one day when I see a first edition of the Big Book, but I understand that the original Big Book, first edition, doctor's opinion, page 1. And the doctor's opinion was, in an effort to understand what the problem was, Bill's mind, which Don talked about, is I want to know what is the problem. And so he starts out and says, we have Alcoholics Anonymous, the reader will be interested in the medical estimate of the plan of recovery described in this book. So once again, Bill substantiates the plan of recovery is where? In the book. Convincing testimony must surely come from medical men who have experience with the suffering of our members and witness our return to health. Well, he says with the experience of medical men, but it's really talking about the medical man that had that experience, which was Dr. Silkworth. So a well-known doctor, Silkworth, chief physician at a nationally prominent hospital specialized in alcohol and drug addiction. Now, a nationally prominent hospital was a very expensive, you had to be wealthy to get in here. This is when, if you were well-to-do and you didn't want to go to the insane asylum or prison, then your family could send you to Towns Hospital. And I believe the number was $700. Don didn't quote a number, but I think the treatment was, at 1930s, was a huge amount of money. So they're running the people are running through the hospital, and Dr. Silkworth's doing his treatment. He does the medical, he does his psychological as best he can. He's getting the best possible medical treatment he can do. He sees 30,000 people. None of them get better, but they make a lot of money at Towns Hospital, and he's developing some opinions. But finally, as Don said, he's really putting his neck on the line here, because there was nobody in the medical profession that was about to say that there was anything wrong with an alcoholic in 1937, 1935, when Bill was there, other than that they're a moral degenerate. And they have no will, and they have no ability to control their lives, and, you know, we're just trying to send them away. So his first letter says, to whom it may concern, I've specialized in the treatment of alcoholism for many years. Doesn't say that he wasn't successful treating alcoholism, but he had specialized in it. In late 1934, I attended a patient who, though he had been a competent businessman of good earning capacity, Bill Wilson, was an alcoholic of a type I'd come to regard as hopeless. In the course of his third treatment, he acquired certain ideas concerning a possible means of recovery. So his third treatment is he's coming in after he's talked to Abby, and he's having a spiritual experience. So as part of his rehabilitation, he commenced to present his conceptions to other alcoholics, impressing them upon them that they must do likewise with still others. So already, Dr. Silkworth is establishing here that by his experience and his experience with Bill, that the most important part of what's happening, one of the most important parts of what's happening here, is impressing upon them that they must do likewise with still others. This has become the basis of a rapidly growing fellowship of these men and their families. This man and 100 others appear to have recovered. Paragraph before, the doctor said, this man is hopeless. All my experience says that he cannot recover. And a paragraph later, he says he has recovered. I personally know scores of cases who were of the type with whom other methods had failed completely. These are facts to be appear to be extreme medical importance because of the extraordinary possibilities of rapid growth inherent in this group. They may mark a new epoch in the annals of alcoholism. These men may well have a remedy for thousands of such situations. That's a lot. Think about it. It's a lot for a medical doctor to put down on paper in the 1930s when there was nothing to substantiate this opinion other than that Bill Wilson and 40 guys had gotten sober. But his experience told him that there was no other solution that he had ever seen. This was the only solution. He said, you may rely absolutely on anything they say about themselves. I marvel at that statement all the time because it's, you know, how does he come from these blubbering alcoholics to you can rely on anything that they say about themselves? So then Bill writes that the physician who at our request gave us this letter has been kind enough to enlarge upon his views in another statement which follows. He's going to say that he confirms what we who have suffered alcoholic torture must believe. There's another must. You never have any musts in AA, but the book seems to be full of it. That the body of the alcoholic is quite as abnormal as his mind. See, I've got to define the problem here. I've got to come to an acceptance of my abnormality, my imperfection. It did not satisfy us to be told that we could not control our drinking just because we were maladjusted to life, that we were in full flight from reality, or were outright mental defectives. These things were true to some extent, in fact, to a considerable extent with some of us. Right. All the things that they're saying out there are true, but they forgot one thing. But we are sure that our bodies were sickened as well. In our belief, any picture of the alcoholic which leaves out this physical factor is incomplete. The doctor's theory that we have an allergy to alcohol interests us. So what's an allergy? The doctor said, I'm going to define this analogy. Look up allergy. An allergy, one of the definitions, is it's an abnormal reaction. I have an abnormal reaction to some substance. So when I first read this and I'm trying to understand what my allergy is, is I'm thinking allergy is I'm supposed to break out in a rash, or I'm supposed to hyperventilate, or I'm supposed to have some other problem, some other manifestation. You know, I can't be allergic to whiskey. If I'm drinking a quart of whiskey a day, you know, and I'm not breaking out in a rash, I must not be allergic to it. But I don't understand what an abnormal reaction means. As laymen, our opinion as to its soundness may, of course, mean little, but it's ex-problem drinkers, we can say that his explanation makes good sense. It explains many things for which we cannot otherwise account. It says, though we work out our solution on the spiritual as well as the altruistic plane, we favor hospitalization for the alcoholic who is very jittery or befogged. More often than not, it's imperative that a man's brain be cleared before he's approached, as he has then a better chance of understanding and accepting what we have to offer. So the doctor is then going to go back, and the doctor then gives us his opinion. The subject presented in this book seems to me to be of paramount importance to those afflicted with alcoholic addiction. Paramount importance. The most important thing I need to understand, the only thing I need to understand, is what is my alcoholic addiction. Not that I'm going to do anything about it. but that I got to set that aside, because as long as I keep looking for the understanding, then I'm not going to be in the solution. I want to understand the problem. I want to understand that I'm it. Dr. Mark, that he was talking about, has a great way of explaining it. Part of what I'm trying to do here is find out. It's like kids when you played a game and you played a game of tag and you were it. And then I got over being it by touching the next guy and saying that you're it. Well, I'm it, and there's no way I can tag it off. You know, I'm here, I'm locked into this addiction. To say this after many years' experience as medical director of one of the oldest hospitals in the country treating alcohol and drug addiction. There was, therefore, a sense of real satisfaction when I was asked to contribute a few words on the subject, which is covered in this such masterly detail in these pages. This is, we doctors have realized for some time that some form of moral psychology, read spiritual experience, spiritual awakening, definition that Don just gave you, was of urgent importance to alcoholics, for its application presented difficulties beyond our conception. Who's saying right there is that the medical profession, as he knew it back then, and it is still the case today, they don't have a conception of how they can, in fact, do the incurable. So it says, what with our ultra-modern standards, our scientific approach to everything, we are perhaps not well equipped to apply the powers of good. Once again, what are the powers of good? The spiritual solution, the spiritual experience, the moral psychology that lie outside our synthetic knowledge. The synthetic knowledge, so that the medical profession wants to be scientific, they want to understand, they want to be able to say, this happens, I can cure it some way. That's synthetic knowledge. That's what medicine's about. And he's saying there is no synthetic knowledge that allows me to approach this. So many years ago, one of the leading contributors of this book came under our care in the hospital, and while there, he acquired some ideas, which he put into practical application at once. Once Bill got it, Bill tried to give it away. Later, he requested the privilege of being allowed to tell his story to other patients here, and with some misgivings, we consented. It's an amazing thing that Dr. Silkworth allowed Bill Wilson to walk around his hospital talking about his spiritual experience as the cure for alcoholism. And then he says, the cases we have followed through have been most interesting. In fact, many of them are amazing. I think that's as close as the doctor could get to saying that they were a miracle. The unselfishness of these men, as we have come to know them, the entire absence of profit motive and their community spirit is indeed inspiring to one who has labored long and weary in this alcoholic field. They believe in themselves and still more in the power which pulls chronic alcoholics back from the gates of death. Once again, it's another miracle. Of course, the alcoholic ought to be freed from his physical craving for liquor, and this often requires a definite hospital procedure before psychological measures can be of maximum benefit. So then the doctor is going to talk about how I'm going to find step one and what happens to my body. Because we believe, and so suggested a few years ago, that the action of alcohol on these chronic alcoholics in them as a manifestation of an allergy. That the phenomenon of craving is limited to this class and never occurs in the average tempered drinker. I cannot satisfy. Phenomenon is something that happens that I can't explain. And when that phenomenon of craving kicks in, it doesn't happen anywhere else except in a certain class of people. These allergic types can never safely use alcohol in any form at all, and once having formed a habit and found they cannot break it, once having lost their self-confidence, their reliance upon things human, their problems pile up on them and become astonishingly difficult to solve. I think it just said that I'm powerless over alcohol and that my life's become unmanageable. And the doctor's saying, that's what I see happening. That's what happens. And then the allergy kicks in. It says, frothy emotional appeal seldom suffices. The message which can interest and hold these alcoholic people must have depth and weight. In nearly all cases, their ideals must be grounded in a power greater than themselves. if they are to recreate their lives. So the doctor says, wow, I don't understand the phenomenon of craving. I think they have an allergy. It's a medical condition. But because they're going to change that, they're going to have to go to step two. They're going to have to find a power greater than themselves if they are to recreate their lives. It's an amazing thing for a doctor to say because it isn't a medical solution. But this doctor's experience says this is what works for them.
I'm waiting for Mr. Ditto.
Mm-hmm.
Don't want to miss anything. Doctor's opinion, we're on page Roman numeral XXBIII. We just got introduced to the doctor's discussion about alcoholism. We just finished talking about the chronic alcohol, the allergy nature of chronic alcoholism. And this is a phenomenon of craving. The phenomenon of craving, which is a problem with our body, which never occurs in the average typical drinker. It occurs, it's limited to our class. This class of people. You make it our class if you don't like to be known as this class. And the next paragraph, he says that the frothy emotional peel seldom suffices. We all know that. No frothy emotional peel ever stopped me from taking a drink. And if the message that can interest and hold these alcoholics must be of depth and weight, then really it has to have depth and weight after I've got to the bottom and I can't get up anymore. That's when it has to have depth and weight, because before I get there, I'm not ready to hear anything. And so then, in nearly all cases, our ideals must be grounded in a power greater than themselves if they're to recreate their lives. Once again, important thing about the doctor here, this is 1934. The doctor, 34, when he meets Bill, and he starts coming to these conclusions. And now you have a medical doctor that's saying that, you know, I got to have a power greater than my, you know. I'm looking at these people, and I'm saying, wow, the only thing that's helping them to overcome this phenomenon of craving, which I see as an allergic condition, an allergic reaction they have, it's an entire class of people, and I don't understand how it happens to them, but I now see that their success, if in fact they can find a power greater than self. That's a huge statement for a doctor. So he goes on down, and then he sort of takes important here, because he takes a real sort of knock at his own profession. He says, if any feel that a psychiatrist directing a hospital for alcoholics, we appear somewhat sentimental. So, you know, he's taking pressure here. He's getting it from all sides about taking this attitude. Let them stand with us for a while on the firing line. See the tragedies, the despairing wives, the little children. Let the solving of these problems become a part of their daily work and even of their sleeping moments. And the most cynical will not wonder that we have accepted and encouraged this movement. We feel, after many years of experience, that they have found nothing, that we have found nothing which has contributed more to the rehabilitation of these men than the altruistic movement now growing up about them. This man has years of experience, worked with 30 plus thousand alcoholics in the hospital, has a recovery rate between 1% and 2%. When he finds the ones, the question would be, are they real alcoholics? But he gets them out of this spin dry situation, and they don't come back. And that's all he's seeing. I mean, if somebody went to you and said, gee, you know, you're a successful physician and your recovery rate is 1% to 2%, I got to be thinking of myself as a failure. What am I accomplishing in life? But the doctor says, wow, once I met this guy, once I saw the work that he was doing, once he starts working with others, now I'm here to tell you that this isn't about sentiment. This isn't about doing something strange. I have found a solution here. They have found a solution. So then the doctor discusses the second part. He's talked about the allergy of the body. I know I'm it. I know if I take a drink, the phenomenon of craving develops, I'm going to keep going. So then what I don't understand is, once I'm sober, once you detox me, what happens with the obsession of the mind? So the doctor explains it. He says, men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. And in my book, I got a little arrow and I said, usually because they need the effect produced by alcohol. The sensation is so elusive that while they admit it's injurious, they cannot, after a time, differentiate the true from the false. Don talked about this a little bit earlier. I don't know. I get to that point when I'm drinking, you know, I don't know true and false. As my disease progresses, my mind continues to tell me that, you know, everybody wants to live like this. They just, you know, they're too much of a wuss to go drinking every day, all day long. They really would like to, like, you know, be drunk 24 hours a day. I don't think there's any other way around it. To them, their alcoholic life seems the only normal one. That's it. That's normal for me. I get up in the morning, I take a drink. I go to the office, make sure everything's taken care of. I slip out the back, go downtown, get a drink. Come back to the office, make sure everything's fine, then it's time for lunch. I'm going to go down and get a couple more drinks. Everybody does that, don't they? That's a normal life for me. I don't have any other way to live. Drunk, when I'm not drunk, I'm passed out. They're restless, irritable, and discontented. Unless they can again experience that sense of ease and comfort, which comes at once by taking a few drinks. Drinks they see others taking with impunity. See, I'm seeking a solution. This is restless, irritable, discontent. And then after I'm in my alcoholism, after I've started the cycle going, then that list goes on and on and on. My sponsor likes to tell me it's not just restless, irritable, and discontent anymore. That's where I started. Now it's shame, fear, guilt, remorse, self-pity, depression, anger, worry, anxiety, anything. Life. You know, I'm seeking a solution to life now. It's about my emotions are out of balance. I can't deal with them. I got to find a solution. Restless, irritable, discontent was where I started. And now I've gone way down that road to absolutely everything. So if my instincts are out of balance, and I can't find an emotional serenity anywhere, I want that sense of ease and comfort. I can't get it any other way. So it says, and I see other people doing it. I mean, why do you get to go, why does my wife get to sit down and have a glass of wine and say, oh, I feel really good and I can't touch it? I don't like that. After this, succumb to the desire again, and that's the obsession. You see, my mind is demanding that I get back to that sense of ease and comfort. That's my obsession. I've got to stop this pain. And I can come up with every reason in the world for it, but the reality for me is, I don't like what's in front of me. The solution to this is in a bottle. I wake up in the morning, I don't like it. Every morning I wake up, I don't like this. Fine, here's a solution. Pick up the bottle. Pretty quick, I don't even like to pick up the bottle, but there's no other solution. I pick up the bottle. And it says, after they have succumbed to the desire again, and that's what I do, I succumb to the desire again. As so many do, and the phenomenon of craving develops, but once I take the first drink, it's going to start. They pass through the well-known stages of the spree, emerging remorseful, with a firm resolution not to drink again. This is repeated over and over, and unless this person can experience an entire psychic change, there's very little hope of his recovery. Wow. This is a medical doctor now telling me that I have to undergo an entire psychic change, which is a spiritual experience, which certainly isn't a medical solution to my problem, but that's the solution that he's talking about. See? All of a sudden, it's like, whoa, well, what was alcohol doing for me? Alcohol was my psychic change. You see? Every morning, I underwent a psychic change. I got up, I threw up, I went in, I got a shot of brandy, put in a cup of coffee, and 15 minutes later, I had a psychic change. And the second brandy made the psychic change even better. You see? I'm wired that way. I'm wired that way. It took me a lot. But first, for me, it took a long time to suddenly say, you know, I'm just here because I don't even want to be there. It's got nothing to do with all these rationalizations that I've had over time. I'm restless, irritable, and discontent. Period, end of sentence. It goes on to say that on the other hand, and strange as this may seem to those who do not understand, once the psychic change has occurred, the very same person who seemed doomed, who had so many problems he despaired of ever solving them, suddenly finds himself very easily able to control his desire for alcohol. The only effort necessary word necessary, being that required to follow a few simple rules. Oh, that's pretty amazing. I'm doomed to an alcoholic death. I'm doomed to die a miserable existence. And yet, if I do what happens, and this is my life right here, if I can have a psychic change, all I have to do is what's required is to follow a few simple rules. So I scratched out of my book rules and put steps. You know? This is the doctor's opinion again. The reason it's up here in the book is when I first read the book, I first open the book, the first thing I come to is someone that I can look outside and say, here's a qualified medical professional telling me that I've got to undergo a psychic change. A man with experience, with tens of thousands of alcoholics, that says, this is the solution that will apply. So the book is trying to orient me to the problem. I got to understand that that was my problem. So these men have cried out to me in sincere and despairing appeal, doctor, I cannot go on like this. I have everything to live for. I must stop, but I cannot. You must help me. Faced with this problem, if a doctor is honest with himself, he must sometimes feel his own inadequacy. Although he gives all that is in him, it is often not enough. One feels that something more than human power is needed to produce the essential psychic change. There's a trained, qualified, experienced medical doctor telling you of his failure, his inability to deal with the problem, that the only thing he sees as the solution is the psychic change that comes from taking the step. Pretty dynamic witness. Alcoholics Anonymous. Through the aggregate of recoveries resulting from psychiatric, though the aggregate of recoveries from psychiatric effort is considerable, we physicians must admit we have made little impression upon the problem as a whole. Many types do not respond to the ordinary psychological approach. In Silkworth's biography, his record was 1 to 2% out of the tens of thousands that he saw. It says, I do not hold it with those who believe that alcoholism is entirely a problem of mental control. I've had many men who have, for example, worked a period of months on some problem or business deal which was to be settled on a certain date favorably to them. They took a drink a day or so prior to the date, and then the phenomenon of craving at once became paramount to all of their interests because the important appointment was not met. These men were not escaping to drink. They were drinking to overcome a craving beyond their mental control. Wow. See, I was always drinking to escape. I never knew that. I was restless, irritable, and discontent. And once I started, I can't stop. And I'm just going to go on. He says, there are many situations which arise out of the phenomenon of craving which cause men to make the supreme sacrifice rather than continue to fight. Don talked about it earlier. On his bottom, he was sitting there with a gun in his head. At my bottom, I was ready to commit suicide. I had two alternatives. I'm either going to kill myself or I'm going to go to treatment. When suicide finally becomes a reality, that's the supreme sacrifice. I have now managed to overcome the most basis of my instinct, which is the instinct for survival. So the classification of alcoholics seems most difficult and in much detail is outside the scope of this work. There are, of course, the psychopaths who are emotionally unstable, and we are familiar with that type. They are always going on the wagon for keeps. They are over-remorseful and make many resolutions, but never a decision. There's the type of man who is unwilling to admit that he cannot take a drink. He plans various ways of drinking. He changes his brand or his environment. There are the type who always believes that there is, after being entirely free from liquor for a period of time, he can take a drink without danger. There is the manic depressive type who is perhaps the least understood by his friends and about whom a whole chapter could be written. Then there are types entirely normal in every respect except in the effect alcohol has upon them. They are often able, intelligent, and friendly people. Wow, so we've just gone through and characterized basically everybody that can be an alcoholic and told us that we're all different. But see, because what we have to find is the identity. What I need to understand is what the powerlessness means And because what I will do with my alcoholic mind is say, I'm not the psychopath, I'm the this, I'm the that, I'm going to look for uniqueness. The doctor's going to tell me I'm not unique, and he's going to say, next paragraph, all these and many others have one symptom in common, the thing that makes us all the same. They cannot start drinking without developing the phenomenon of craving. Period. This phenomenon, as we suggested, may be the manifestation of an allergy which differentiates these people and sets them apart as a distinct entity. Wow. I don't know whether it's good or bad that I'm a distinct entity. It has never been, by any treatment with which we are familiar, permanently eradicated. It has never been, by any treatment with which we are familiar, permanently eradicated. That statement the doctor made back here in 1939 and 37 is true today. The only relief we have to suggest is entire abstinence. This is incurable. This immediately precipitates us into a seething cauldron of debate. Much has been written pro and con, but among physicians, the general opinion seems to be that most chronic alcoholics are doomed. Okay. What is the solution? Perhaps I can best answer by this relating to one of my experiences. He's going to give you two stories, and one's Hank Parker's story, and the second story he's going to talk about is Fitzmayhew's story. Do you want to give some history on those two? Let me finish with this one thing, though. And we talk about a lot of times about what is alcoholic behavior and what's not, and Don passed me this article. Dr. Silkworth wrote was reproduced in the Grapevine in 1947. And when we talk about, you know, he says, makes it pretty clear that as a distinct entity or as a separate class of people, there are alcoholics. And in the end, sometimes you start to get that thinking that, you know, there's also a uniqueness in being an alcoholic as opposed to being something else. You know, I got an allergy. That's what I got. And I got an obsession. That's what I got. But he says, and he was talking in this about human nature. He said, it is very wrong to consider many of the personality traits observed in liquor addicts as peculiar to the alcoholic. Emotional and mental quirks are classified as symptoms of alcoholism merely because alcoholics have them. Yet those same quirks can be found among non-alcoholics too. Actually, they are symptoms of mankind. My restless, irritable discontent, shame, remorse, guilt, you know, I just have a different solution than the next guy has because I happen to have an allergy and an obsession for alcohol. So that when my life is not my life, my emotions are out of balance, my instincts are out of balance, all of which were my case, and in spite of the evidence in my life, you know, growing up in an alcoholic family and knowing that when I took the first drink and didn't take a drink until I was 18 years old, at that moment, the turmoil in my life, the emotional instability and everything else had all packed up there and had nothing to do with my alcoholism. Until I took that drink. Yeah. And all of a sudden, at that instant at 18 years old, I had a solution. And I adopted that solution. And when the solution didn't work for anymore, I still kept that solution. I kept it for 36 years. So the doctor ends the doctor's opinion with two recovery stories, one on Hank Parker, one on Fitzmayhew. Okay. So it says, about one year prior to this experience, a man brought in to be treated for chronic alcoholism. He had been partially recovered from a gastric hemorrhage and seemed to be a case of pathological mental deterioration. He had lost everything worthwhile in life and was only living, one might say, to drink. He frankly admitted and believed that for him there was no hope. Following the elimination of alcohol, there was found to be no permanent brain injury. He accepted the plan outlined in this book. 1 year later, he called to see me, and I experienced a very strange sensation. I knew the man by name and partially recognized his features, but there all resemblance ended. From a trembling, despairing, nervous wreck had emerged a man brimming over with self-reliance and contentment. I talked to him for some time, but was not able to bring myself to feel that I had known him before. To me, he was a stranger, and so he left me. A long time He passed with no return to alcohol. When I needed a that was Hank Parker. Hank Parker, who we're going to talk about more in Bill's story. When I need a mental uplift, I often think of another case brought to me by a physician prominent in New York. The patient had made his own diagnosis and decided his situation homeless, had hidden in a deserted barn, determined to die. He was rescued by a searching party and a desperate condition brought to me. Following his physical rehabilitation, he had a talk with me in which he frankly stated he thought the treatment a waste of effort, unless I could assure him, which no one ever had, that in the future he would have the willpower to resist the impulse to drink. His alcoholic problem was so complex and his depression so great that we felt his only hope would be through what we called then, what we then called moral psychology. We doubted if even then it would have any effect. However, he did become sold on the ideas contained in this book. Interesting word, sold. He had not had a drink for a great many years. I've seen him now and then, and he is a fine person, a specimen of manhood as one could wish to meet. I earnestly advise every alcoholic to read this book through and through, and though he came to scoff, he may remain to pray. Dynamic statement from the medical doctor in 1937.
A little bit about Parker. Parker is the guy who wrote the only thing that Bill didn't write to the employer. And he gives you his, he was in the book, they took him out when he drank. He had a lot to do with the writing of the big book. He wrote the outline for it, and he wrote to the employer. And he and Bill were partners in this book, a works publishing company. His story to the employer, Standard Oil Company, that's who he worked for. And so he knew how to buy wholesale from Standard Oil Company, and he started a business called Honest Dealers. And they went around to the filling stations and various people that handle oil products and said, if we get a bunch of people together and you contribute so much money, we can buy this stuff by the car load and get a big discount on it. And then you can retail it out and make your profit, and I'll take mine for setting the deal up. That's what they were trying to do. And so he had a little business set up in New Jersey, and that's where Bill started writing this big book using Ruth Hawks. I don't want to go too much into that because we can get lost. That's a long story. He will go back out after 4 years, and he will die in a sanitarium, which indicates to me that he died from the disease. Fitz Mayhew, on the other side, came in on 10 of 35. And these are Bill's first two sponsorees, called Pigeons in those days. And he dies in 1943. He never drank again, but his body was so beat up that for 8 years, it only took him 8 years to pass away. But he'll stay sober. All right, let's talk about Bill Wilson.